Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 114, recorded Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: awful winter travel and hospitality beats awards. So I'm coming to you today from the JW Marriott in New Orleans on Canal Street. Was going to record this in the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago. Planned to watch the sort of foot and a half of snow in the front yard begin to melt. But I didn't get this written in time, so I ended up on the road doing it this week here in New Orleans. So a little bit behind schedule, doing something a little different for this podcast, and that is while I am recording the audio of this in the JW Marriott, I also have my GoPro camera going, kind of sitting on top of the Zoom recorder, and I will put this probably fairly raw up onto the website for those folks who want to torture themselves in seeing, you know, how I actually go through the recording of this. I'll call it Travel Commons Uncut, because I think you'll see quite a little bit of toy boating, and you'll probably be happy that I do a good bit of editing. So anyhow, you know, it's interesting. Like I said, finally this March, and actually this past week, we finally had melt. Finally had temperatures in March now starting to crack, get above freezing. You know, this February in Chicago tied February 1875 for the coldest February on record, with an average of about 14.6 degrees, which was 13 degrees colder than the average February, which, you know, sort of has made me happy to head to O'Hare in February, especially when I was flying south. So mostly down here to New Orleans, but you know, there was a flight to Phoenix that really made me smile. I think it was 15 degrees when I left Chicago and about 70 degrees when I landed. And there, you know, I spent, quite honestly, spent as much time outside as possible trying to resolve what I had figured was going to be a vitamin D deficiency. I did get a chuckle on my last night there, though. I was sitting outside a bar, and I don't know, it must have been, you know, sort of in the low 60s, and they had the heat lamps on. It was great. I also flew to Memphis this past month. I tell you, the flight selection in and out of Memphis just gets worse. I mean, that airport has become a ghost town ever since Delta dismantled the Northwest hub there. Indeed, they now have a two-year project to shrink the airport. So they've sort of demolished, I think they've started this, but they're going to demolish half of the A and C concourses, mothball what remains, and then kind of consolidate everybody into the main, into that middle main B concourse. You know, it's kind of surprising when some airports are at capacity with people sort of sprawled everywhere. And then there are other airports like Memphis where, you know, quite honestly, some of those concourses could double for bowling alleys. It kind of does make you wonder, right, how much does the economy have to improve before the airlines start to add back some of the capacity that they ripped out during the Great Recession? So actually, this last week, tempting the travel gods, hoping for better weather with sort of two up and backs to the East Coast, a day trip to Newark, and then an overnight trip to Philadelphia. And so, you know, sort of as a precautionary sacrifice, I doused my travel tube of Crest toothpaste with kind of an extra bottle of Dewar's Scotch that I got for my last first class upgrade. And then I lit it all on fire, kind of that sacrificial offering. It worked part of the way. 75% of my flights were on time, which, given the track record that I have had over the past couple of months, I think the sacrifice worked.
Look at my yellow worm, squashed and red face in a spider's cocoon nest, have you now laid me down to rest like a
tent? So, following up, kind of spelunking through my Twitter feed, you know, another thing that made me smile on my flight down to Phoenix last month wasn't so much that I had scored a first-class upgrade on American, which I did, but it was that upgrade let me hear a woman ask, sort of right as she's walking onto the plane, she has to be reseated away from the plane's Wi-Fi access point because she's allergic to Wi-Fi. Now, you know, I mean, just when you think you've heard just about everything on an airplane, I mean, this was just absurd in so many ways. How did she make it through the terminal without going into sort of anaphylactic shock? I mean, you run a Wi-Fi analyzer app on your phone or your tablet the next time you're in an airport, and you'll see that you're just sort of wading through kind of this sea of Wi-Fi signals. And what about the passengers sort of sitting around her? Because I tell you, nobody remembers to shut off the Wi-Fi on their laptop, no matter what the flight attendants say. And I guess she didn't stop off at Starbucks on the way to O'Hare either. I mean, and I don't know, as it was, the flight attendants just sort of looked at one another like they, or really anyone, would know exactly where the go-go access point was located on that 737. And like they'd want to rejuggle seats on a 737 that's completely full of families heading out to Phoenix on spring break. They just, you know, politely mumbled, we'll ask somebody, and sort of gently pushed her down the aisle. Taking mass transit to and from the airport is sort of a running theme, fixation, here at Travel Commons. So I immediately clicked through a tweet when I saw it from Nate Silver's 538 blog that went geekily deep into that topic, comparing public transit and drive times from airports to downtown for the 40 busiest U.S. airports. Now, it's interesting, only Minneapolis, Honolulu, and Chicago, and for Chicago, it's both O'Hare and Midway, only for those three cities is public transit quicker than taking a cab. I mean, and now if you open that range a bit, say anything within 5 minutes is a push, then the list gets a little bit longer. Then you pick up Washington, Reagan, Atlanta, San Diego, San Francisco, and Austin. Open it up to 10 minutes, 10 minutes longer on transit, which, you know, absolutely could be worth it given the cost difference between your typical transit ride and a cab ride. And that, you know, that brings in Boston, Charlotte, Seattle, and San Francisco, but from Oakland this time, from Oakland Airport, and also New York's JFK. Now, a number of these work because they're close in airports, so Chicago Midway, Washington Reagan. Others work because the highway traffic is just so awful, notably O'Hare and JFK. Now, the list is ranked, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the post, and the list is ranked by public transit time, and for the top 15, plus JFK, which is number 30, public transit times are reasonable enough to make the cost-convenience trade-off compelling. Now, some of the airports below the line, below that 15 that I know, New Orleans, Orange County, California, Detroit, I mean, I don't know that I've ever even seen a public transit sign in those places. Now, actually, Portland, PDX jumped out at me. I talked about taking the airport light rail. I've talked about that in an earlier episode, probably a couple of years ago, probably in 2013. I'll tell you, it's a nice service, but it really takes a while. It makes a lot of intermediate stops, and so it doesn't compare well to a cab ride that takes half the time. Now, of course, the gold standard is London's Heathrow Express, which is a 15-minute straight shot from Paddington Station versus, say, an hour cab ride. But I got to tell you, that's not a real apples-to-apples comparison. I mean, a Heathrow Express ticket is £21.50, so that's over $30 versus, say, $5 from O'Hare or $7.50 for JFK. I think the better comparison might be the £5.70 or $8.50 at current exchange rates, the £5.70 ride on the Tube's Piccadilly line that takes 50 to 60 minutes from Heathrow into downtown London, which, you know, actually that would fit it right at about number 16 on the U.S. list. Now, waiting out an unbelievably long delay on a United O'Hare to Denver flight, I ran through all of my reading material, electronic versions of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, physical versions, a physical version of the Chicago Tribune, my Feedly newsreader stream, multiple refreshes of Twitter. And so at that point, now I'm done. And so I had to dive into the seat back pocket, the emptiness of which reminded me of Sky Mall's, of the Sky Mall magazine's bankruptcy at the end of January. So, a little moment of silence. Sky Mall was always good for at least 15 minutes of entertainment, kind of that went along the lines of, who in the world would buy that, right? The zombie statue crawling out of your garden, the kickboard suitcase, the NFL wine shoe holder. So I thought that until last Christmas when a friend of mine bought my present out of Sky Mall, a 6-bottle leather wine holder that hung from the crossbar of my bicycle. Stunning. I can't wait for the snow to melt to try that out. So I only fly Delta when I absolutely have to, like when I'm going to Atlanta or going to Memphis. So I didn't notice, actually, when they canceled Sky Mall back in November. They just, they canceled that contract and pulled all the magazines out of the seat back pockets. So, Delta said in the release, we saw a decline in customer use. Yeah, I got to tell you, every electronic thing that I just went through that I had read on this United flight prior to reaching for SkyMall, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, my Feedly stream, Twitter, I could add Facebook. If I was younger, I could add Tumblr. I think the minute the FAA allowed us to keep tablets on during takeoff and landing, SkyMall was a dead man walking. And speaking of tablets, last month, I thought I had left my Google Nexus 7 tablet behind on one of my American flights home from New Orleans. It was one at that, kind of at that point in time, it was one in what seemed to be a stream of stuff that I'd lost on the road. A couple of pair of sunglasses, some earbuds, and now this damn tablet. I mean, really. So I ended up going to the American Lost and Found in O'Hare. The woman came out from behind the cage with a stack, had to be like 10 to 12 sort of 7-inch Android tablets, Lenovo's, Samsung's, but none of them were mine. And I could see she had a similar size stack of iPad minis that she had pulled out. So, I mean, it looks like this thing happens a lot. I think the move that the airlines are making from solid to mesh seat back pockets is going to be a good thing. But that weekend, as I continued to steal my wife's Nexus 7 tablet, I realized how much I had really used my tablet. That 7-inch is a great form factor. So Sunday night, I hopped on Amazon and started cruising around seeing, what it was going to cost me to replace it. And I ended up that I found a refurb 8-inch Samsung Galaxy Tab Pro for $200. Sold. I bought it on my son's Prime account for cheap next day shipping. And it's really a nice piece of kit. I really like it. Bright screen, quick performance, which was a pleasant change. Because after Google had pushed the latest Android update, Lollipop, to my old Nexus 7, like the performance on this thing, on that thing just completely cratered to the point of like nearly being unusable. Switching to the Samsung was nice not having a 2 to 3 second lag between screen touch and reaction. But then that following week, as I was sort of going through my backpack to get things packed to go out on the road, adjusting the contents, my notebook, my Bose headphones, and now fitting in the Samsung tablet. I don't know, I was having problems getting everything to fit, which was goofy because there wasn't that much. So I reached in to move some stuff around. I found my Nexus 7 tablet. I hadn't left it in a seat back pocket. I just lost it in the depth of my backpack. I think I got to get a non-black case for the Samsung. So hey, if you have any thoughts, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment, send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always go old school and post your thoughts at the website, travelcommons.com. All right, the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is awful winter travel. Now that the U.S. snow cover appears to be retreating, though Boston did get more snow this last weekend, I'm hoping that we can sort of bid farewell to what was really a lousy start to the winter, at least from a travel perspective. It kind of caught me by surprise because the start of the winter season, sort of end of November through December, I mean, it wasn't bad at all. But, you know, January started to have its problems, and then February, you know, it was just 4 weeks of travel hell for just about everywhere in the U.S. east of the Rockies. Sort of cold, snow, ice, wind, you know, kind of like the four winter horsemen of the travel apocalypse. You know, every week seemed to have another disruption. I mean, I think it kind of started with the snowpocalypse that wasn't in New York and New Jersey, right? I mean, mayors, governors closing offices, schools, roads, towns on the forecast of this massive, huge, historic, I actually think they started running out of adjectives, snowfall, only to see what, I don't know, 4 to 6 inches. But everyone had flights delayed, canceled. I mean, it seemed to take like the next couple of days before everyone, you know, got back in the traces, only then to have a real snowstorm the next week blow them back. I think I had a string of, I want to think, 3 Mondays of flight cancellations. I mean, I'd get on a weekly conference call and half of everybody was not where they were supposed to be. Sort of canceled flights, diverted flights, working from home. I had one colleague trying to fly from Fort Myers, Florida to Memphis for work, obviously, on Delta. Lands in Atlanta, only to find that they had canceled his flight to Memphis due to an ice storm. Well, all right, well, when can I get there, he asked. We don't know, they said. What? No, we have no idea when Memphis Airport is going to open. So he just turned around, went back home for the week. and actually, his clients couldn't even get to the, couldn't get into their office for the next 3 days. So, you know, as I mentioned in the last podcast, in the last episode, I tried to be a bit more strategic in my travel in February, picking some warm spots where I could, you know, sort of, and then avoiding known trouble spots. I mean, I cringed whenever I had to fly to the East Coast, but sometimes I got lucky. I hit San Antonio on a 70-degree day. The day after I left, it dropped down to 40. And then, like I said at the start, I managed to wrangle a half week in Phoenix in mid-February, mid-70s and sunny. Like I said, I was outside every day. Flying home, it was 77 degrees when I left Phoenix, minus 2 degrees when I landed at O'Hare. I thought I was going to shatter when I walked onto the jet bridge. I think, though, the pinnacle of this January-February maelstrom was really, you know, sort of the end of February when the Delta jet slid off of LaGuardia runway, hit a fence, and came within yards of dumping into Jamaica Bay. Now, landing at any of those small near-in airports, LaGuardia, Washington Reagan, Chicago Midway, quite honestly, I mean, they just feel like, you know, you're putting that thing down on an aircraft carrier because there's not a lot of room for error. Add snow or ice, I tell you, I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. I mean, luckily for the Delta pilot, this one wasn't fatal. Not like the Air Florida crash out of what was then Washington National on a snowy January, or the Southwest 737 that slid off the end of a Midway runway, went through a fence and into a street intersection, crushing a car that was waiting at a red light right there, killing a small boy from Indiana. No, I mean, this one with Delta and LaGuardia, I mean, it was just more of an inconvenience, right? Closing LaGuardia for 7 hours, taking a big chunk of capacity out of what is already the most overcrowded and overtaxed airspace in the country. A friend trying to fly home to New York that afternoon, she boarded her flight. It pushed back, was about ready to kind of make that pivot to go onto the taxiway when they pulled it back in. It got, you know, they had canceled it. She was, it was just one more delay. She was lucky she got out much later that night. I actually was a little luckier. Even though I was flying from Memphis to Chicago that day, some piece of my flight, I don't know, the plane, the crew, got caught up in that whole sort of East Coast mess. But thanks to the wonders of mobile message updates, I was able to track the delays from, I will tell you, the relative comfort of a Mexican bar in East Memphis. So one margarita with a high school buddy turned into two, which turned into dinner when his wife joined us. I, unlike so many others, got home that night, and I had something other than bad airport food to show for it. The next week, yet another delay on my New Orleans to Chicago flight, late inbound aircraft. But why? I mean, sort of O'Hare and New Orleans were fine. All the weather again was in the east, but no one knew. No one knew what caused the delay, not even the pilot. I mean, when we finally boarded the flight, he just keyed his mic and he said, look, I'm awfully sorry about this delay. I wish I could tell you why, but I have no idea. The plane arrived, Chicago on time from San Antonio, and then it just sat there. I wish I could tell you, but I don't know why. Maybe it got lost behind a snowdrift. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is hospitality beats points. One morning, in some concierge lounge in some Marriott or Sheraton that I can't quite place, I opened my umpteenth warming dish, looked in at yet another pond of runny scrambled eggs, and wondered, really? I mean, how difficult is it to properly cook institutional egg mix? Just about every poll of status, top-tier hotel travelers rank free Wi-Fi and free breakfast as the top amenities. The ones that you would think would keep travelers working to maintain status. But when you actually go to use those amenities, they're often not so great. Slow Wi-Fi, even the enhanced speeds that Marriott promises their Gold and Platinum members, semi-liquid scrambled eggs, and stacks of overcooked bacon. Which is a problem because just about every hotel chain in the past couple of years has raised the number of points needed for a room and also created a new top tier for kind of the best or most popular properties, added, say, a Category 6 onto the first five so that they can charge even more points for that Maui property, right? So it ends up just sort of devaluing that big point balance, your vacation savings account that you road warriored so hard to build. So if points aren't worth as much anymore, what keeps travelers loyal to a brand? I mean, what keeps you staying in, say, a Marriott for 75 nights or doing 25 stays in a Westin so you can make top-tier platinum? I mean, it should be those amenities. But, I don't know. How much loyalty is, are those scrambled eggs worth? I mean, they're convenient, but they don't seem to differentiate much. Now, some places actually are ditching the whole lounge idea. I've been in some Renaissance hotels and a Marriott Autograph hotel that they serve free breakfast in the restaurant. There's still the standard-looking buffet, but if you have the time, you can order anything off the menu, and it's comped, and it's some good food. Blows my diet a bit, but, it beats four mornings straight of watery scrambled eggs. I've noticed, though, that I'm being offered more specialty perks at places that I'm staying a lot. The Sheraton here on Canal Street, New Orleans, will occasionally offer me basketball tickets. Actually, the New Orleans Pelicans are actually doing pretty good this year when Anthony Davis isn't injured. And they had some special grandstand deals to watch the Mardi Gras parades in some grandstands that they built right outside the hotel, right on Canal Street. Now, I didn't take them up on either of the offers. I've always had things going, a dinner or something else going. But you know what? It was nice to get the offer. I mean, it made me feel appreciated. It's kind of what I call the cheers effect. You want to go where everyone knows your name. And when you're away from home, that's important. You want somebody to smile and ask how you're doing. And it's not just hotels. So the morning barista crew at the Starbucks on Canal Street and, in St. Charles, so just a block up from here, I mean, those guys fire up a spinach feta wrap when they see me walk through the door, even when it's been a couple of weeks since my last visit. Of course, there is a fine line that can be crossed. Like a friend of mine, she received Christmas presents from a front desk clerk for years after she did about an 18-month gig that had her traveling weekly at the Trumbull, Connecticut Marriott. Or for me, the best one was when I first started traveling on for business back in the mid-80s, I was commuting between Dallas and Chicago. I was living in Dallas at the time, and so I was passing through the DFW Admirals Club every Monday morning. And after about 3 months, one of the women, one of the agents behind the desk who was checking us in, you know, I'd gotten to know her. Again, she had a Monday morning shift. I saw her every Monday morning. So after about 3 months, though, she asked me if I'd like to meet her daughter. This was kind of a potentially awkward situation. But in what I still think was one of my best moments, I looked at her and I asked her, do you really want your daughter dating someone who travels as much as I do? She thought about it for a moment and looked at me. She said, yeah, no, not really. So awkwardness averted. And we went on to have a really nice friendship until I moved back to Chicago about a year later. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 114. I hope you all enjoyed this show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. And if you're interested, go to the website and check out the accompanying video, the Travel Commons Uncut. I don't know how this is going to work. You guys will have to let me know. But anyhow, as always, you know, sort of check out the show notes for music links. I have no idea what music I'm going to choose for this, what bridge music I'm going to have. Again, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along text or audio file, I don't know, video, who knows, to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter, put something on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, and links to all of these are in the show notes, or you can always post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Anyhow, thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send emails, tweets, and to post comments on the website. And until we talk next time, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
On the road, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing ease my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling,